Next case is 05-1464, Dayton Supply and Tool Company versus Montgomery County Board of Revision. Mr. Demuzio. I'm sorry. Mr. Wilburton. Excuse me.
Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel for the appellee. I'm Merle Wilburton from Dayton and appearing on behalf of Dayton Supply and Tool, the property owner in this case. It's with great respect for this court that I'm here today arguing a basic position of what constitutes the unauthorized practice of law. And I do it with great deference to this court and great appreciation for my practicing over 30 years in the state of Ohio, and I appreciate and respect the opportunity to make this argument. This argument, and as I speak about the unauthorized practice of law, I also refer to the language in the opinion of Sharon Village, particularly Justice Sweeney, who talked about approaching the unauthorized practice of law and its contours of definition. And I think that was a critical thought that keeps coming back to me again and again as I go through this case. As we all know, Sharon Village in 1997 ruled invalid a complaint on a real property valuation that was prepared, signed, and processed by a third-party evaluating firm as the illegal practice of law, and dismissed that complaint, and in subsequent cases in the Supreme Court dismissed cases that had arisen prior to that. In response to that decision, the Ohio legislature in House Bill 694 amended 5715-19 by expressly providing that a whole list of people could sign that complaint for evaluation in front of a board of revision, including officers of corporations, partners in partnerships, realtors, appraisers, a laundry list of people that could do that. That issue has since been discussed and decided in several courts of appeals and the Board of Tax Appeals. It has not been brought directly to this court in Rubbermaid, I believe it was. This court ruled that that decision could not be applied retroactively. In other words, for cases that had started prior to the Sharon Village case, the legislative act in amending 5715-19 could not be applied retroactively, that was an unconstitutional act. And what I thought was interesting about that language was the language in there that said, but for the amendment, that complaint would have been invalid, which said to me that if not the legislation is there, the complaint would be valid. And so I read in Rubbermaid a negative suggestion by this court that the legislation has validity. I think it's appropriate to have validity given the nature of the Board of Revision, and I've tried many cases, I've been in front of many Boards of Revision, I've been in front of many of Board of Zoning Appeals in different jurisdictions throughout the court, and I know and from reading the statutes and the rules applicable to that non-lawyers typically initiate cases in all of those jurisdictions, and I note that in the cases they often refer to boards of revision, boards of zoning appeals, as quasi-judicial bodies. Now, I confess that I'm still not sure what a quasi-judicial body is. I believe it means there are elements of the judicial process in it, and there are elements of the administrative or executive or governance of it in that. And in that context, it seems to me when the legislature passed HB 694 and amended 571519, it was speaking its view to the extent it had the ability to describe and prescribe what rules would apply in practice before boards of revision. And I say that with...
Well, counsel, couldn't it be a little more narrow and still be helpful to your case? All they really did is say that if it's a corporation, and if it's an individual, that individual can represent oneself as our rules about the practice of law allow one to do that. And if it's a corporation, which is where we get involved in all of this, that an officer or employee of the corporation can represent that. In other words, they attempted to make a living, breathing human being, put someone in the same shoes for a corporation as an individual property owner could be. That is, they could go in and represent themselves. But that would still keep out all of the other folks who had their own little law practice going, representing individual property owners and corporations, and were practicing in this area in something that we determined was the practice of law.
Well, Justice Pfeiffer, I heard your comments in the previous case about discouraging cottage industries, and I believe that this provision can be decided along the same lines. The property owner in this case was signed by the executive vice president of the corporation, and this case is that narrow case. The corporation asking for the opportunity to make its presentation to a board of revision, no different than it makes its that it speaks through the executive vice president or the president on a whole range of documents that might be described as legal documents, and including such things as perhaps as of a small claims court. You know, I don't want to create...
I guess what I'm suggesting, that becomes a closer question as to whether or not the General Assembly can do that than it would if they came back and tried to enable all these non-lawyers to practice in front of these, of this administrative or quasi-judicial or whatever you want to call it. I think sometimes that term means the standard rules of evidence may be loosely enforced as much as anything.
I agree with you, Justice Pfeiffer. I think the ruling that we're asking for in this court, in this case, is that a corporate officer has the ability to initiate a proceeding in the Board of Revision.
But is that a legislative determination under 57, as the legislature has said, or is it belong to this court under the Sharon decision authored by Justice Sweeney? Isn't that really the question that you have to address?
That is a question that can be addressed. I think there are other ways of avoiding that if it needs to be, but certainly the one issue, and some of the courts of appeals have discussed it in terms of whether or not it's an evasion of the authority and responsibility of this court and under this court's authority and inherent responsibility under the Ohio Constitution. So on the other hand, to the extent that this quasi body is an administrative function, I think it is a legislative act, and we need to respect it to the extent that...
Well, would that be right? I mean, you can practice law in front of many administrative bodies and be engaged in something that's clearly the practice of law. The nature of the entity that you're in front of doesn't necessarily change the question whether or not that's practice of law, does it?
No, Your Honor. I was probably more expansive in that, and again, I was limiting to the amendment insofar as it relates to corporate officers signing on behalf of a corporation. When I look back at, I'm sorry, Justice O'Donnell. In terms of the legislation, I also think the court can look at the legislation as the advice of the people or the voice of the people, no different than this court is always looking at the law as a changing body of law, and particularly in this case, and that's why again I refer to the contours of the definition of the unauthorized practice of law. By way of explanation, I grew up on a farm, and we lived on the hills, and we did contour farming. And what I discovered then is how you did the contours on one hill was different than how you did the contours on another hill. And in this case, I think with the definition of what Sharon Village was really about, which was the cottage industry of the appraisal firms going out and doing it, with the legislation passed by House Bill 694, and with the practice that we have, I think we have a different landscape now than we had when Sharon Village was decided. I think this case is a different landscape, and I think it's an opportunity to draw a different contour as to what side of the practice of law this is. You know, one of the aspects of contour farming is to prevent erosion in the environmental sense, but I also recognize that the contour line drawn in the unauthorized practice of law is to draw that same line to protect erosion, where you ought to be given the opportunity for corporate bodies to act on some things that are within below a certain level.
I'd like to explore that with you for just a minute then. How far do we let the corporate officer extend into the process? It's one thing to fill out a form and say the Smith Corporation would like to have a re-evaluation of its tax assessment in this instance for these tax years. Something else if there's a hearing, something else if there's an appeal from that hearing, and how far do you foresee the ability of the corporate officer, president, fiscal officer, CEO, to participate along that line?
I would draw the line pretty narrowly, Justice. I would draw the line that he can fill out the form and do it, and then I would encourage that the legislature or this court direct or advise the Board of Revision people saying, now if you're coming to a hearing, you need to have an attorney, or you need to sit there and sit quiet, and whatever is in there is in there. But I would not in any view authorize or believe that a corporate officer ought to be examining or cross-examining an appraiser from either the county or a school board or someone else, or even leading the direct testimony.
And you don't find any of the bases for the complaint to be problematic with respect to the practice of law as to a reason for a reassessment or for the auditor to go back and revisit that evaluation?
I have filled out a lot of complaints, and I think everybody out there, property owners, understand that their basis of taxes is the valuation of the property.
Too
when
high,
they get their
generally.
Tax bill,
too
it's
high.
Too high, and they know it should be lower, and I think they know enough to put in the number that's low. So I don't see anything unique in the practice of law to filling out that form and say, I think the value should be lower than what it is. And I don't, the forms that I filled out don't go into any legal issues at all. It's strictly a discussion of fair market value.
Counsel, I remember a pretty big case here in which filling out the form was a disastrous hoop for the perinuclear plant because they left blank the value that they thought it should be.
I am not here to advocate that we have to tell them how to do it, but I don't. Yeah. But I think the.
So I mean that's a case that we've written on, mm-hmm. where the big problem, and I don't recall exactly how we resolved that. I think we left that become a minor error and let the case move on its merits, as I recall the outcome. But it was a huge matter, just how that initial application was filled out.
I think that potential is there no matter who fills it out, but I don't think that goes to the practice of law. I think it goes to common sense and the ability to understand valuations, and I think property owners do that. If I may, I'd like to speak quickly about the second issue, which is under the assumption that the first complaint was ruled invalid, that the second complaint justified jurisdiction. The complaint filed by the school board was filed prior to March 31 on March 28th, and the Board of Revision had its hearing. The Board of Revision did not dismiss the appeal. When the Board of Revision issued its opinion, it upheld a value. It didn't dismiss the case. We appealed that to the Board of Tax Appeals. We expressly provided that we were appealing the decision on the complaint by the Board of Education. And as was stated in the CIA Properties case, the statute doesn't discriminate between one complaint by a property owner and a complaint by anyone else. They are all complaints for purposes of the statute. They're all parties to the case. And in this case, I believe the Board of Revision honored that, respected that, made a decision on that, and we appealed the decision expressly providing that we were appealing the complaint filed by the Board of Education, which was filed on March 28th of 2003.
Your red light's been on. You need to sum up.
So on that basis, we would urge the court to consider that as a complaint, and that the complaint was validly filed and conferred jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilberding. Now, Mr. DiMuzio.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Dave DiMuzio, and I'm the attorney for Dayton Schools. The appellant's real goal here today is to have this court overturn two of its relatively recent precedents, Sharon Village and CIA Properties. I'm not sure Mr. Wilberding mentioned it, but there's actually been a long series of cases after Sharon Village, and I've personally been involved in many of them as counsel for the school districts, in which this court has repeatedly upheld the concepts in Sharon Village. So there's been this effort almost every time it comes up to get it changed, but for the most part, with a couple of exceptions, there was one, and I think it was the Ameritech decision, where it was narrowed a little bit. This court has decided that the Supreme Court ought to control the practice of law in Ohio. The legislature should not be allowed to dictate through statutes how that's done, and I think the court has been pretty consistent in indicating that it feels it has that power and it wants to retain that power. The Supreme Court should, in fact, control the practice of law in Ohio for several reasons. Legislature should not be allowed to expand the practice of law to non-lawyers, to accountants, to real estate agents, to officers of corporations, et cetera. I should mention, I didn't come prepared to talk about this. I didn't realize it would be a question from one of the justices, but this issue of expanding it or perhaps limiting the extension simply to corporate officers, there are grave dangers in doing that. If you look at the original Sharon Village decision, it was very well written, and it went into some of the public policy reasons for not allowing non-lawyers to do this. One, of course, is the absence of malpractice insurance. If a mistake is made by a corporate officer or an accountant, real estate agent, there may not be malpractice insurance, which you would, of course, have if there was an attorney. Also, the statute, as this court's aware, 57-1519, has a three-year bar if a person makes a bad filing because they're not a lawyer. They would be barred for the balance of that triennial from getting a reduction. There's a case this court decided called Gamarino that dealt with those issues. A bad filing is a filing for purposes of the once every 3 year rule.
But I guess if a corporation, if we were to adopt Mr. Wilberding's argument, if a corporation wants to take the risk of having its corporate officer file a document, that's their risk. I mean, there's not a client that's involved. Unless you want to call the corporation as a separate entity a client, but the officer is an employee of the corporation, and if corporation wants to let the officer, who's not a lawyer, try to get it right. If he doesn't, he or she doesn't get it right, the corporation pays. I mean, it's their risk.
Certainly. I guess I have a couple of responses. One is, not only is there a danger to the client, in this case the corporation, but there's also public policy reasons not to permit non-lawyers. As was also mentioned in Sharon Village, there is this Rule 11 issue of you know, an attorney knows enough to know there has to be a good faith basis for the filing. I personally, as an attorney, sometimes do work for taxpayers. They approach me and they ask me in these cases if I'll help them. And one of the first questions I ask them, if it's not in the district of one of my clients, is, what do you think it's worth? And as soon as they say it's worth two or three times what it's on the tax rolls for, I explain to them the dangers of going forward, that they can, in fact, not only is the risk that it stays the same, quite frequently I see these tax values go up because the person doesn't know what they're doing and don't understand the fact that once the value's in play, it will play out as long as the jurisdiction continues. But you're right. I think in a corporation sense, we don't necessarily have the same problem that we do normally. But
counsel, don't corporate officers at least have a fiduciary duty to the shareholders to make the right type of decisions? And if you have a corporate officer that goes ahead, especially on something as important as evaluation of a property, and makes a mistake, and as a result of that mistake, additional taxes are burdened upon the corporation, the shareholders are at a loss for that.
I would agree, and I guess I would argue that supports my position, because really it's not just the corporation that suffers. There's real people here that suffer. And they suffer if this court were to change the rule. They could potentially suffer because of the change in the rule. If that corporation had done the proper thing and hired an attorney, and the attorney had made a mistake, they would then have malpractice insurance to protect the shareholders. So I think, you're right, but I think that those arguments, I think, could in fact cut both ways. I also wanted to mention, and I don't want to be forced into this position, because there was no transcript made of the BOR, the Board of Revision decision in Dayton. They simply have a tape. My recollection, and I could be wrong, was that there was no attorney that appeared at the BOR hearing. That was my I don't know if Mr. Wilbring has a different recollection, but my recollection was that there was no attorney. So it was more than just filling out this form in a technical sense. They didn't have an attorney appear at the Board of Revision hearing. There was simply the president of this corporation who appeared. So again, please don't feel this is simply a hyper-technical question of who filled the form out. That's not what happened here.
Once it's in play with the filing of the complaint, nobody has to appear, do they?
I'm sorry?
No one has to appear, do they?
No, my point is that
the Board of Revision still has to review and decide that matter.
I don't think
whether the school district or the taxpayer or anybody else shows up.
My understanding through the practice in this area has been that normally the Boards of Revision will dismiss a case. They don't have to proceed. If nobody shows up, they'll dismiss it for failure to prosecute. So they don't have to, once they get jurisdiction, proceed. As this court's aware, the whoever files the complaint, be it a school board or a taxpayer, has the burden of proof. And if they don't show up that day with proof, it can be dismissed. And it often happens I've been involved where the school shows up as the counter-complainant. Taxpayer does not
Counsel,
show up.
Counsel, how do you deal with, or does it have no application, what this court did in the workers' comp area?
I'm sorry?
What this court recently did in the workers' comp area.
I'm not familiar, Your Honor, with that.
Well, we said non-lawyers can practice all day long in that area, in the administrative process.
I'm not familiar with those decisions. I do think the court's decision was correct in Sharon Village. There are potentially massive amounts. I was personally involved in a case where a taxpayer showed up in Hamilton County Board of Revision asking for a reduction in a building that was on for about $8 million. It was raised to $30 million. So there are very real dangers in having these non-lawyers appear. I also want to mention on the corporation end, I forget the name of the case, I think it was called Union Savings, but this court has, since the early 70s, taken the very strong position that corporations are not persons, and that corporations can only file suits through attorneys. So it's more than just a Sharon Village issue. It's an issue that's been around for a long time. On the second issue of the CIA property, again, it's clear to me that the court's majority decision was correct in the CIA case. And in this particular case that I'm involved in here today, there was a countercomplaint filed. The school board clearly marked the countercomplaint, referenced the original complaint, asked for no change in value. No reasonable person could look at that set of facts and conclude that it must have been an original complaint. It was clearly a countercomplaint. I disagreed strongly in my brief with appellant's position that since there's no mention in the record of when the school board got its notice, it must have gotten it after March 31. That is not a proper support. If the board wants to remand this for further facts, we can produce the actual copy of the notice.
Is the reason that the council wants the counterclaim to survive is that they can get in through the counterclaim what they have not been allowed to get in on the direct?
Yes, that's their hope. And again, our position is that under CIA, this court, I think, spoke strongly that the countercomplaint is in the nature of an answer, should not have its own jurisdiction in and of its own. And if I found their argument interesting, but as I mentioned in the end of my brief, if they're right, and the legislature meant what it said, that the county auditor and the Board of Revision should only notify after March 31, which then, of course, means school districts can only counter after March 31. To me, that means that there was no jurisdiction for the school district's countercomplaint, which in turn means that they cannot piggyback on ours because ours had no jurisdiction either. There was a mention of the perinuclear cases. I think they're referred to as CEI cases. There's a whole string of Cleveland Electric illuminating cases. The first important one dealt with this issue of core of procedural efficiency, whether or not looking at the mistakes that were made on the complaint, do they rise to that level? There was a subsequent CEI case involving perinuclear in which this court decided that the statute required that the tax commissioner be specifically notified by the Board of Revision of its decisions. And this court took the position that's what it says and we're going to enforce it. Recently, in the Berea City case several months ago, this court, I think, correctly decided the statute says what the statute says as to the efficacy of sales. And the court felt that's what the statute said. Here, if the court decides that in the 571519 requirement for notifying school districts, it must be after March 31, then to me that means that there's no jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction for the filing that we made.
Mr. DiMuzio, let me just characterize this if I have it correctly. This is a relatively uncomplicated situation where a corporate officer filed a complaint with the Board of Revision seeking a tax reduction.
Yes.
The issue seems to be whether or not that officer can do that pursuant to 5715 or whether the Supreme Court regulates the practice of law. Is there a rule of law that you think this case should stand for? Do we go all the way to declare the statute unconstitutional? Or what is the rule of law that you think we should write as a result of hearing this matter?
Yes, I think this is the case where the court officially says we find the statute to be unconstitutional. I was involved in one of the earlier narrow decisions where this court found it to be partially unconstitutional in the Cincinnati School District case where there was retroactivity involved, and the court specifically said we're not ruling on the main issue of the constitutionality statute, but we object to the retroactive nature of this. But I think you can certainly do that. I think this is probably a good case to do that, but you don't have to. I think you could decide it, but you could accept their argument that or you could narrowly look at this and say, could they piggyback on the school district's countercomplaint? I think you could honestly say under Berea, under CEI, we are going to, and all the way back to the American Restaurant case in 1946, a statute means what a statute says. We are going to strictly construe jurisdiction as it applies to statutory appeals. And you could do that. You could find that my countercomplaint lacked jurisdiction. We know theirs did under Sharon Village. And there, so you could decide it in that narrow sense, or you could decide to just overturn the entire statute.
If we rule in favor of your opponent, what happens to your countercomplaint then?
I'm trying to think. Well, the Board of Revision proceeded on the merits of our countercomplaint, and actually on the merits of their original complaint. it wasn't, and they ruled in favor of the school district. It wasn't until the BTA, when the taxpayer appealed to the Board of Tax Appeals, that they had a chance to put on their witnesses, and the BTA then decided that there was no jurisdiction based upon our motion under Sharon Village. So I guess I haven't thought that through. I assume that if the BTA is overruled by this court, we still have, I assume it would be remanded for a merit hearing or at least a review of the merits based upon the witnesses that were presented earlier. Thank you. Do I have additional time?
Well, you have a minute and 48, 47, 46, 45 seconds.
Thank you. I also wanted to mention that, and again, I've got no questions on this, so I don't know which way the court views this, but this whole issue of whether or not there's evidence in the record as to when the school district was or was not notified, we feel that there is some evidence. If you want to remand it, we can provide the notice, the actual notice from the county. But there is some hard evidence in the record. We know that the countercomplaint was filed by the schools. We know that the countercomplaint contained a copy of the complaint. So we can certainly infer from that that the school district was notified before March 31. And we were filing a countercomplaint. It's not conclusive, but it's certainly a reasonable inference. That's all I had, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. DiMuzio. Mr. Wilberding, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
On the second issue, the CIA property issues, I would note that the complaint that the school board filed was, in fact, filed on March 28th. They talk about all the stuff that was attached. When you look at that form, an equally fair inference is that they printed off a whole bunch of typed complaints, and because there is nothing filled in on a typewriter on that complaint that refers to this property or this property owner or anything else, and it's all see the attached, and then they attach whatever they want to. So I think that's their short form way of preparing a complaint, that it wasn't necessarily in response to a notice of a complaint or anything else. It is a complaint. And as a complaint, as a counter complaint, to me, it's just like a common pleas. You file a complaint, the defendant may file an answer, he may file a counterclaim. If the complaint itself filed by the plaintiff is dismissed, the counterclaim is still alive. And that would be true whether or not the only reason he filed the counterclaim was because the initial complaint was filed. So I think the complaint filed by the school board has to stand on its own merits.
Counsel, I'm interested in procedurally, if we ruled for you and on the narrow basis that you suggest, saying that the statute doesn't offend our power to regulate the practice of law insofar as it allows corporate officers and employees to file the complaint only, and you suggest stopping it there and saying you can't go in and make a presentation. The suggestion is here that that's what happened. So if we ruled for you on that narrow basis and sent it back to the BTA, could they look back and say, there was no lawyer present at the hearing either?
I think they would find, if they listened to that record, that there was no corporate officer who made a presentation who acted as a lawyer. I think that's where the line needs to be drawn, that you shouldn't permit him to do it. There was no appraiser at that Board of Revision hearing, not by the taxpayer, not by the school board, not by the county.
Wonder they lost then.
I share that.
Thank you, Mr. Wilberding.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.